This is CliffCentral.com. Future CEOs on CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to Future CEOs here on Cliff Central. My name is Gareth Armstrong. We're live from Johannesburg, South Africa. And it is a great pleasure to welcome you, our listeners, to the show. And then we've got another fantastic CEO lined up for the discussion that we're going to have today. What do we do here on Future CEOs? Well, it's all about closing the gap between you and those who we look up to, those who have gone before and are succeeding in certain kind of ways, and we're looking at them when we're admiring them. Why do we do this? Well, it's to help you expedite the growth of your career, the growth of your business. Make sure that you also potentially don't make some of the mistakes that those who have come before have made. They're going to guide us through some of this. Greg, it's great to have you on the show. Welcome to Cliff Central. Welcome to Future CEOs.
Thanks, Gareth. Thanks for having me on the show.
We so appreciate you being here, but what we're not going to do is we're not going to change the way that we do things, which is always to ask the CEO or our guests to introduce themselves. We're always interested to see how they do it, and there's some insights there for us. Please, would you take 30 seconds, a minute, and just introduce yourself to us and to the listeners who are out there?
Sure, sure. Gareth, I'm the CEO of a company called Bravo Group. We are furniture and sleep product manufacturers. We've got 10 factories and assembly sites around Southern and Eastern Africa. Mm. And we manufacture and market brands like Sealy, Edblow, King Coil, Slumberland.
Yeah, these are on the bedding side. And then Lazy Boy on the other side.
And on the lounge side. So we've got the two major divisions, the sleep products division. And then on the lounge side, we've also got Lazy Boy, which is also under license from the States. We've got Grafton Everest, a household name in the country. Gomma Gomma, also a household name. And then Alpine Lounge as well.
That's a little bit of pressure there. A Lazy Boy, there's a certain expectation around that it sounds like you have to, in large part, fulfill. There's a promise.
Oh, certainly. Yes, yes. Well, we've got an obligation to the licensor. We've also got obligations to licensors like Sealy and King Coil as well.
Yeah.
And our obligations are to make sure that the brands grow in the countries that we operate in.
So whenever I have, I'm the princess and I feel the pee, but it's not really a pee, it's the mattress and it's a Sealy. We actually shouldn't be saying, damn, Sealy. We should be saying, Bravo Group, Greg, what's going on here?
Yeah, sure.
Okay,
sure.
Interesting.
Yes. Look, we customer service is what it's all about. And I don't think our company would have grown over the years if we hadn't concentrated on customer service. In fact, Bravo Group itself started in 1895.
It's an old organization.
It's a very old organization as the Transvaal Mattress Company in those days, and that's we've grown from there.
Yeah, and you also have a fascinating journey. So I think you've done a really good introduction on Bravo Group. I'm very interested in you as a CEO, and so an organization like that needs a specific kind of leader. And also what also seems to happen is that there are different moments for different types of leaders to be placed into an organization. That's partly why boards exist, to be able to measure what it is. And now you've been asked to step in. You were asked to step in about 2013 or
yes,
so.
Yes.
Can you give us a little bit of background?
Yes, it's the furniture industry over the last probably 10 odd years has gone through some tough times on the retail side especially. And obviously what's happened on the retail side has an impact on the manufacturing side. Back in 2013, our CEO at the time left the company, and the shareholders or the directors put in somebody else as a CEO, and I took one look at. I was a CFO at the time, and after a month, I thought to myself, you know, this guy's going to destroy the business.
Oh wow!
And we had a shareholders agreement that needed quite a large majority to approve the appointment of a CEO and directors and the like. And we went into a board meeting after a month, and one of the items on the agenda would have been, you know, appointment of the CEO confirmation. And I had told the chairman and one of the directors beforehand that you know, management wasn't happy about it. So I had to object in the board meeting, and it was really tough because I had the guy sitting next to me that I was objecting to.
Wow.
And about a month later, the board decided he had to move on, and I certainly didn't do it for myself to become the CEO, but
absolutely,
that's what actually happened. So I just felt that this guy, he tried to rule by fear, and that's just not my style, or how I thought our company needed to be ruled. So or led, and so I've been the CEO since then.
It takes a certain kind of courage and steel to be able to do that. I'm very interested to explore how that steel and courage has developed over time with you. I kind of just want to take a couple of steps back as we do that, though. So let's begin a little bit with your journey, if we can.
Sure.
So you grew up where? Just tell us a little bit about the formative years of you, please.
Yeah. One of five children, and grew up in Durban. Had a good education. I went to St. Henry's, it's a Marist Brothers school in Durban. When I left school, I was only 16. I'd started school young and finished young. And as you did in those days, I went off to the army, and they took one look at me, and the senior guy then said to me, "Does your mother know that you're here?" So I said, "Yeah." So he says, "No, you're too young to be in the army," because I was 16.
Yeah.
And so I went home, and my dad, who was in practice as an accountant, said to me, "So, well, you start work for me tomorrow."
Oh, right.
And that's how I became an accountant. I signed up articles, and I did everything part-time. In fact, in those days, it was 6 years part-time, and so I did that part-time, and then after that, I went on and specialized for another 2 years part-time in tax. Mm. I did tax as well. And then I went to the army when I was old enough to go to the army.
when that same CO of sorts could say, "Okay, all right, you're welcome back."
Yeah.
I see that your father has had a big influence on your career. I see that it has come out in our notes here. Just can you tell us a little bit more about that?
My dad. He, as an example of perseverance. He wrote the board exam 12 times.
And oh, wow.
I forget what years that must have been, probably in the 40s or 50s. But he eventually qualified, and he was in partnership started off with his cousin in Durban in a small firm. And I think when he retired, it was a sort of small to medium size firm in Durban, and that's where I did articles.
Okay.
When I finished articles and I qualified, I said that I wanted to move on and sort of developed for myself. So I joined a couple of guys in Umhlanga in a small practice there. And after about 5 years in practice, I decided I wanted to see what the outside world was like rather than being in practice. And that's when I went into industry.
There's a courageous step there. I'm seeing as a common theme that we're going to have to explore this courage thing. As I consider you as a CEO now, and I consider a little bit of what we're going to be revealing as part of your career and your growth and your development, the standout question for me is, at any point initially anyway, so you've described how your father pulled you in and said, "You're going to start working for me," and you've got positive things to say, but have you resented that at all in any form or fashion? Because when I ask the question, what really drives you? Very few people say accounting or finance, and so I'm just trying to figure out you a little bit here.
Yeah, when I was at school, I always had a dream of being a farmer.
Okay.
But my dad always said to me, "Well, if you want to become a farmer, you become an accountant first, and then you buy your own farm at a later stage."
Mm.
And I've stayed as an accountant, and I haven't bought my farm.
Not yet.
Yeah, but I don't really have any regrets about it.
The language of finance is certainly a very important language to learn. In your experience, have you had moments where you've been frustrated because it's such a vital language and not all people can speak it? Can you speak about maybe a moment or two where that has been a frustration for you?
Understanding the financials of a company and what we're talking about. Fortunately in our group, if I can liken it to our group, we've got in the various divisions, each division has got its own strong management team. Mm-hmm. And within the management team, you will have an accountant, a CFO, CFO for the division. You'll have a chief executive, a sales exec, and all that sort of thing. So each division, although the other execs wouldn't really understand the numbers in detail, you would certainly have a financial person who would understand the numbers and help direct the numbers in that division.
I do understand that a lot of CEOs, and I would say almost 50%, maybe a little bit higher, that come through this door and we speak to or have a finance background. Often, because of a financial background, people are quite tight-fisted with money. Is that something that you feel burdened with, or is it something that has actually enabled you?
Look, there's obviously different characters across the spectrum. Yes. And from our point of view, it's possibly as you get older, I don't know, but I would say to a certain extent you become fairly risk-averse. Mm. And especially with the responsibility that you carry as well, you know, you can't just go out and maybe do things that you might have done if it was your own money that you were managing. So when you're responsible to a board of directors and responsible to outside lenders and the likes of those, then you have to be risk averse, you know. Mm. That's...
How do you make the decisions that you need to? So, in your position, you've got, I think, over 3,000 people that report into the group itself. Yeah. In total.
Yeah.
You've got a large operation that does large amounts of revenue, and so when you make a decision, that decision has a fair distance of travel and echo and impact. How do you approach the decision-making process?
Well, you've obviously got to work through the formal structures in a group, and I account to the board. So what we would do is we would present our plans to the board and have some vigorous discussions at the board about our plans. And you know, we've got non-exec board members as well who would give their input from their experiences elsewhere. And once we've come to an agreement with the board on what the strat will be and where the plans should go, then it's really up to us as management to execute.
Yeah, to enable, yeah.
And just from an execution point of view, I certainly believe that it's not any one individual that runs the business. I see the business as a team of people. Mm. And even in our little head office, we run as a team, even though we've got the teams at the divisions as well.
You started quite low in the Bravo Group, is that correct?
Yeah, I started off in High Point in one of the factories as the financial manager, and then I sort of worked my way up mainly on the financial side within divisional and group structures, right to where Bravo is now as the finance person, and then, as I said, in 2013, I became the CEO.
What potentially has helped you to rise the way that you have? So if you look at yourself in relation to your peers, especially if you go back maybe 10 years or 20 years, whatever is appropriate, and you look at yourself against those individuals, what has made you different? Why do you stand out when, I mean, you potentially have an equivalent technical understanding, but yet you rose beyond them? What's the difference? What's the X factor?
I'd say hard work is a good start. Mm-hmm. and, you know, sometimes you have to stand up and be counted when you have to. So, mm-hmm. you know, I could have easily just not stood up and be counted at the time that I really thought the group would have had a problem with leadership. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, yes, you have to be stand up. And, you know, being in a CEO role or a senior role, it's not a popularity contest, you know, but you certainly have to do what your conscience tells you to do.
Has that been a guiding light for you, your conscience?
Yeah, Gareth, I would say honesty and integrity in business to me it's one of the key points to follow in business.
I want to challenge you on that, because it seems, and it just seems on the surface, I think when we dig down into it, maybe we'll see a different story. But often what we see is so many people that are potentially dishonest getting ahead.
Well, that was probably one of my early mistakes in business, is that when I left practice, I went into industry, and I went to work in a company that a friend recommended that I go into. And it turned out that the guy who owned the business really wasn't an honest person. Mm. And my problem is I trusted him in the beginning. And eventually, after a year or so, I thought, no, I just couldn't be there anymore. And I think that was probably one of my earlier lessons, is that unfortunately, you can't just trust everybody openly. You have to understand and know the people before you can trust them.
If you were to retrospectively now look back and say, what questions didn't I ask that I should have asked, what would be your top two or three questions to guide someone toward knowing someone? Because it's difficult to know someone, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's difficult, because even in an interview, if you interview an accountant, you say to the guy, do you understand journal entries? And he says, yes. But until he actually passes the journal entries, you don't really know. Mm. So yes, it is difficult. Look, we use psychometric testing, which helps us at work as well. Mm. But to understand people, I think, and work people out is an advantage if that is part of you, to be able to do that.
Now, as I sit here, I get the opportunity to try and work out some really senior people, and we generally scratch the surface. What I understand about you already is that there's a certain courage and grit that you have. I want to add to that by simply adding that, amongst so many other things, you've also completed seven Comrades Marathons. I mean, that's a significant thing to be able to do. Let's talk about that for a moment. I don't think I could, in any lifetime, have the ability to get up in the morning at 3 a.m., whatever it is, 5 a.m., run for a couple of hours in preparation on a year in advance to go and then do a race which is about 100 kilometers long and still finish. That's something quite remarkable.
Yes, it is. But I did those comrades when I used to live in Durban. And, the weather in Durban is quite friendly if you are a runner. So, in summer you run without a T-shirt, and in winter you put a T-shirt on. So sure. That's a bit different from running in Joburg. But what was really great about, I used to run with a crowd called Regent Harriers in Durban North.
Okay.
And towards Comrades, there would be about 300 people arriving on a street corner in the morning, and they would call a run and off you would go. And what's great about running is it's a great leveler. Mm. You meet all sorts of people at 5:15 in the morning from all walks of life. And, the fast guys go off, and then the slow guys like myself all sort of trundle off behind. And you meet so many people, and it's a great way to start a day.
It's an interesting thing that you've described, which is potentially power, or it's given you a certain kind of power and ability in a leadership space to understand that diversity can be leveled through certain kinds of universal experiences.
Yes.
Has it served you in your work?
Yeah, look, I think as far as I'm concerned, I would like to think that people see me as a respectful person to whoever they are in the organization and whoever we deal with. And it's important to me that our business is seen to be respectful in its dealings with people. Mm. And I would hope then that in turn people would respect what I do and how I do it. I think, one of the early lessons I was told by a chap I used to work for in practice was that you earn respect, you don't demand respect. Mm. And I think that's the important thing.
Let's pull back into your journey, because what I'm also hearing is that you're quite modest, and you have said, well, I just rose, and it was a natural part of it. But what I'd really like to do is understand a little bit more about some of the more conscious things that you've done as you have been rising. And so I'll say it slightly differently. What we understand and what we've asked many, many times as CEOs, what did your job and your responsibilities and your day look like when you were just starting out, and what does it look like now? And so everyone will say, well, it was very technical back then, 90% technical, 10% people. If you were to flip it on its head now, what are you looking at?
Yeah. Look, in the early days, you would arrive at work and sit in your office and grind through on the accounting side. Mm-hmm. And you would have, you know, a sort of smallish team of people reporting to you on debtors, creditors, cash book and the like. And then as you move through the role, what you find is that you're dealing with a more diverse group of people. So it's not only accounting people. Mm. So you're sort of moving out of your comfort zone where you know the accounting side, and you're dealing with salespeople, production people, technical people, HR people, dealing with customers. So you have to grow as you go along, and not always easy, but and people test you as you move along, you know. Okay. They certainly do.
When you say test, is that in a positive manner? Is it a conscious thing?
I think, you know, in the beginning, as you move from one role to the other, staff working for you as you rise will try and test you because, you know, you've eventually got to make the hard calls, but you know, maybe they'll try and go back to the person that they used to work for or something like that. But, you know, these are all things that probably help you to grow as you go along.
There was a formula that I once learned about interactions with people. And so even when you and I first met, which was just a short while ago, immediately what happens is that there's a process that occurs, which is an acceptance process. Do we accept each other? And there will be barriers to that acceptance. And that can be as mundane or silly, potentially even as how we dress, to how we greet each other. Did you shake my hand too hard? And suddenly I resent you for being stronger than me, or whatever the case is. So there's this acceptance process, and then there's a credibility thing that happens very, very quickly as well. And we assess ourselves on credibility. And then to bring it all home, do we leave each other or part company having empowered each other or offered some kind of value to each other? And that happens in a very small microcosm every time we interact with people, but it can also happen over time, the cycle that unfolds.
Yeah.
And so what I'm hearing you say is that there were definite parts where people were testing your credibility, and you have to, in order to be able to remain leadership sound to them, stand that test.
Yes.
Have you experienced moments where people have disappointed you as you potentially have tested them? So I think about the CEO that you described that you had to replace.
Yeah.
And the board felt that you were the best replacement. Other moments, maybe early on in your career, where you, again, perhaps trusted someone too easily and then they didn't stand that test. Can you share?
Yeah. Look, you're going to come across at various stages in your life, you know, that people that will disappoint you, that's how life is. Mm. But I think the important thing is you have to move on, you have to believe in yourself, and you have to grow from it. So, and even in my position now and dealing with some people that I do deal with, yes, you come home and you are disappointed with the way things went with that person, but you've got to carry on. You know, you just have to pick yourself up and keep going.
I'm just wondering how someone, especially the younger generation now, they are very focused. Often there's this almost juxtaposition, this thing that seems like it shouldn't be together, which is they seem very inwardly focused, but then there's also this altruism that is seeping through young people's pores. They want to be part of something bigger and better and greater. And I'm just wondering how you have also then dealt, as you are now more and more senior in a role, with diversity from an age perspective. So how have you been able to work with people that are brimming with confidence, not always real confidence, but then also they're pushing other kind of boundaries? Just an interesting question there.
Yeah, look, I think you can always work with somebody who has got the right attitude, and the right attitude would be, what can they do for the company before what can they get out of the company?
Okay, that's a really good point. The right attitude is not selfish.
What I can get out, it's what I can put in.
Good
and
test.
And then in doing so, it'll just come my way. But don't go with the attitude, well, you know, this is what the company owes me, because that to me, and it's often when people say to me, geez, you know, my son's running in a little sports meeting on Wednesday morning. Do you mind if I put in a leaf for him? I say, please, man, if you don't count the hours, I don't count the hours. And I think that's a great way to work, you know. So you treat people responsibly and with respect, and they must just give it back to you like that, you know.
Yeah, what I appreciate about what you're sharing is Mark Ashton. I know he won't mind that I drop his name into the mix here. The former CEO of MoneyWeb, he on an ongoing basis, because of his desire to reach out and to support, gets emails from individuals, and they're always looking for something free. Now, this is an interesting point. This idea of mutual, something that's mutually beneficial. And what's making me think about this is just what you're describing, which is don't look out for yourself. If you can solve someone else's problems, they're going to probably give you their money to solve their problems. Yeah. And in this particular, in Mark's case, he's on an ongoing basis getting people that just want stuff for them, but they're not solving a problem.
No.
And so Mark's not interested in engaging with him, not because he's not a nice guy, but because he's bought into the idea, the notion that, well, you need to have a mutually beneficial transaction that occurs.
I think so too, yes. And I think as a leader, you can sort of teach your employees that that's the attitude, and that's the attitude you would like them to have as well. And often it works. Often it works. We've got some great people at Bravo. And they certainly, a lot of them don't count the cost to themselves. They see what they can do for the business first.
As part of a retention strategy, it's always good to find good people up front. So not try to retain them through different means and money and stock interests and so on. In your experience, how have you been able to keep the best people, especially when there are potentially bigger salaries and bigger paychecks and bigger options waiting in the wings? And I mean, people are quite aggressive often when they make those kind of approaches. How have you done the retention thing? How have you balanced that?
Yeah, look, the furniture industry, especially on the manufacturing side, isn't what you might call a sexy industry. You know, it as a chartered accountant, I'm sure you'd prefer to be working in merchant banking or that sort of thing, and it will be a stockbroker and, you know, earn nice big profit shares and all that. But I think it's the work environment that I think it's the work environment that people get to enjoy. It's a challenging environment, certainly. I mean, furniture industry is certainly not easy, but it's the environment and the support that you've got from your other your colleagues and your peers, and I think it's once you've got sawdust in your veins, you become unemployable elsewhere.
Oh, so, really? Is that true? Okay. So I won't let the sawdust get into my or too close to it. Let's jump back into a little bit more of your story. One of our favorite questions to ask is, when you reflect back on your career, there was a moment, or there have probably been multiple moments, but there was a moment that you probably hung your head in shame or tried to hide from someone because you made a mistake. And you probably could just say it was pure naivety that this mistake happened. What was that mistake for you, and potentially what did you take from it? But what was that mistake?
Yeah, Gareth, well, let me put it this way. One of the hardest decisions I've ever had to make, and the mistake was that I delayed the decision. It was to close a factory, and
that's a difficult thing.
The factory had employed about 1,200 people, and you know, it's not only that the 1,200 people, but you can maybe, you know, multiply that by say 5 or 8 or 10 people who rely on those people.
Exactly.
And that goes back in my early days as the CEO, when we had a strike, and just after that strike, where there was quite a long strike, and then there was another strike, and the division just wasn't able to recover from that strike, and the board said to me, you've got to close this business, and I said no, and we tried to come up with all sorts of plans, the management and myself. And I was really trying to support the management, and eventually, after we lost quite a lot of money, And if I hadn't taken that decision, I'm sure it would have had a real bad detrimental effect on the rest of the group.
Mm.
So that was really where we got to, is that if we didn't close that business, then it would really affect our other divisions. And then I had to go to the board and say, you know, I'm sorry, I should have made the decision earlier. But that was tough. That was, you know, yeah, to
that I can imagine.
Yeah,
especially the emotional burden that comes with that.
Yeah.
But to your point, and I've heard it so many times before, leadership is can be a lonely road, and it has to be.
You know, even though you work within teams, at the end of the day, you know, you get into bed at night and you think, you know, I've got to make the decision.
Mm.
And sometimes you have to make the call. And that's how it is. But that's what you got to accept with the role. Yeah.
Do you rely on external sources for either coaching or mentoring or advice? Or are you a bit more of a lone wolf type of individual, which there are? There's different types of people in the world. Because I do know that the person that you most want to meet is a coach of sorts, which in Robin Sharma. So you have
I've read his books.
You've got a great deal of admiration and respect for him. But do you actively go out and search and interact one-on-one, or do you hold a distance and rely on books and other insights?
No, Gareth, I was very lucky. When I took over as the CEO, there was a guy that was in our organization. He was running one of the divisions, and he had been with the company for about 35 years, and he had grown up through the ranks to be the chief exec of this division. And I chatted to him and I said, don't you want to come to head office and become the chief operating officer and help me and guide me? And we worked together. I mean, I think I only let him retire probably at 67 or 68 eventually. So he retired about 18 months to 2 years ago. But really, Mike was a great sounding board, a great friend, just a great guy to have next to you, you know, in your learning years. So I was very lucky.
Yeah, I mean, and you were lucky there for a number of reasons, which is the ability to learn from. But then also this idea of trust. The ability to trust someone cannot be underestimated, especially in an environment where often things can either go south or be cutthroat or whatever the case might be. And so that idea of trust mustn't be overstated or underestimated in any form or fashion. In fact, Greg Solomon, CEO of McDonald's South Africa, says that one of the ratings that he does, which is very subjective, is he will look at an individual and he'll say, okay, Greg, let me rate you on two things. Do I respect you? And then he'll give you a rating out of 10.
Mm.
And then he'll do that on the trust side as well. So do I trust you, or how much do I trust you? Rating out of 10, subjective. Of course, informed by a whole bunch of other things. And then he'll multiply those two numbers together. And if it doesn't go over 80, then he's not going to pull you into his team.
Yeah.
And so, you're good at math. So you'll know that to get 80 is a tall order. 9 and a 9, 8 and a 10, something there. But it's a good or an interesting way that he measures how to work with someone. And it's quite subjective as well.
Yeah, and I think it should be important to young people to understand that, you know, your working career spans a number of years. And if you want to succeed, you certainly have to build up trust. You must be able to let people trust you and respect you as well. And if they haven't got that trust and respect, you're going to go nowhere eventually.
How do you do that in the face of performance demands, though? So someone you've developed a really good relationship with, someone they trust you, the team trusts you, but this person isn't really performing the way that they need to, or potentially something else happens in the market and you don't see it coming, and this person's in the firing line. How do you deal with someone, dismiss someone, cut someone out, but while other people are watching, and still maintain their trust? That's a tough one.
I don't know
if you've experienced it.
No, it certainly is a tough one. And every now and again, you have to say to somebody, look, you just don't fit into the team, or, you know, we're going to have to part company. But you certainly don't want to do that. And you try and work with the person as much as possible. But eventually, sometimes you do have to make a decision to cut ties.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there has to be very clear well-communicated reasons why you're doing it.
Yes.
And well-communicated, perhaps in that moment to the other team would be inappropriate, but at some point there would have to be communication that spills over into the other team members so that they can understand what's going on.
And what the process is that you went through as well.
Yeah. So that leads me into a question, which is when you look at yourself and you reflect on your own leadership, what are the two or three things that you lean on time and time and time again that have seen you through the years, that your three pillars of CEO leadership?
I think one of the most important, as we've spoken about quite a bit, Gareth, is, let's say, honesty and integrity. I think that's vital. Teamwork, learning from other team members and sharing ideas with other team members. And then as you grow into leadership roles, you've got to take accountability. And you certainly can't be a CEO if the buck doesn't stop with you. Let's put it that way.
I accept accountability as something that has to happen. But what happens if things aren't actually your fault? You still have to take accountability, and you're still standing in front of a board, and you still have to answer for something. But what happens if something's genuinely not your fault?
Yeah, these things do happen. But at the end of the day, you're the face of the business, and you do take accountability. I think it's just important that, these unfortunate situations, you just make sure don't happen too often.
Yeah.
Because then they certainly look at you and say, well, it is your fault. But I think if you're honest with your board, they'll understand. That's where I think the honesty and integrity comes to play.
I like that. The idea that what you mustn't potentially do is hide behind either excuses or something that you mustn't hide the problem either. So you must be very open and very honest with those that you're reporting into as well.
Yeah, look, if there's bad news, you tell them the bad news. You don't try and cover it up and hope you can trade your way out of it or do anything like that, you know. And sometimes it's difficult to deliver the bad news, but to me, it's better to deliver the bad news and then say what your plan is to recover from it. But I'd much prefer to be that way than not to be upfront about things.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And what I appreciate is also the fact that you practice what you preach. So you've described a scenario where you were sitting next to someone. It took a great deal of bravery to do it, and you delivered news. You delivered your verdict and your opinion.
Yeah, you have to.
How do you deal with disappointment? How do you deal with the frustration of what is sometimes very difficult, heavy burdens that you have to carry as a CEO?
Yeah, I think probably I bottle things up a bit, but I still try and stay fit. So get out there and even in the gym, sometimes it's a good place to help clear your head when you're sitting on a bike, a stationary bike in the gym. And sometimes you help, you solve your own problems really just by having those quiet moments to yourself. So I think fitness plays a big role in helping to deal with the stress and frustrations.
We had a conversation with Dr. John DeMartini. Maybe a name you're familiar with, but he's a very big fan of telling us that we're a multifaceted individual, that there is a physical side to us, there's a mental side to us, and whether we want to acknowledge or not, certainly his words, there's a spiritual side to us. And so we have to be congruent, number one. And so his voice is repeatedly, if there's something off or amiss, or you're feeling unhealthy, there's a misalignment across those three persons or characters that makes you. But then also you must use or bend the rules of each of those to suit you. And what I'd hear you saying is certainly from there's probably a mental element to it, but certainly from a physical element, you've bent your body to respond to you. And there's a physiological thing that happens when you're exercising. It makes you happier.
Yeah. And also when I was writing board exam, in probably 1978, somewhere around there, there was a guy who, probably the most clever person I've ever met, a guy called Charles Hutting.
Okay.
And he used to run what we call the board course right around the country. And in the first lecture that he gave us, he said, you guys need to be fit to write the board exam. And that's what really started me. The next morning I went out and I probably did a couple of kilometers on the pavement.
Okay.
And yeah, that's what started my sort of journey on the fitness side, let's put it that way.
So can he also take the credit for you potentially finishing Conrad's?
Well, that's where it all started. Yeah,
that's where it started.
Yeah.
Well, no, thank you, right. Charles.
Yeah, no.
That's a remarkable opportunity or thing that he's been able to open up for you. You've got a philosophy in life that you never take anything for granted. Where does that come from?
You know, I think certainly you've got to appreciate the blessings that you've got and you must just appreciate what you've got and don't take anything, as I say, don't take anything for granted. Really, it's, you don't deserve everything, you know. So I think, if you work hard and you can enjoy the fruits of your life, well, that's great. But certainly nobody, I think, can demand or deserve until they've put in the effort. So don't take anything for granted. Health, you don't take for granted either, quite frankly.
I reflect on a number of people that I've interacted with and where they, and I'm probably one of those people, we live out in the future. We try and live 10 steps ahead. And really what that does is it eliminates possible opportunities for happiness and contentment and probably excitement and a whole range of other important emotions. Are you like that? Do you live a little bit out there? Or does this philosophy guide you to be in the moment a little bit more?
Oh, look, I certainly do like to set myself goals. I mean, just something if you say live in the future, my next goal is to ride Bergen Bush with my daughter in October.
Lovely.
So, you know, I do like to have things to work towards. I think that's what drives you as well, you know. Mm. So you've got to have some sort of aim in life and something to work for.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, especially in your position, what you always are doing is you're always chasing something.
Mm-hmm.
The board is always expecting you to chase something. Is there a moment that you have been chasing something, but as a result of perhaps a blind focus, a laser-like focus, you've missed something?
Yeah, look.
And how do you avoid that?
Yeah. It's
I'm sorry, I'm asking all these questions, but you're giving really substantial answers, and we don't always get that. We often get fluff, and you're not doing that. You're helping us.
Yeah, look, everybody's different, and everybody approaches a leadership role in a different way. And maybe one of my failings is I try to get into the detail as well. So, I keep on writing things down because I need to check on them or make sure something's happened. So, you've got to be very careful. I think you can't let things slip through the cracks in our position. You know, you must make sure, you must follow up. Say for example, very rarely, but every now and again, I would get an email from a customer who said, I didn't get good service.
Mm.
And I would go back and phone them and then make sure that the whole loop is closed, that whatever the bad service was is definitely resolved. And I'd phone the person back and I'd say, are you happy? And they'd say, thanks very much. So, I think you've got to close loops as well as you go through.
There's a leader and his background is in aviation, and the way he says it is you've got to land the plane.
That's it.
Just get the plane down.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it's in the air, there's potential for disaster. But land the plane, get the projects landed, and then we're in a good space.
That's it, yeah.
A final question or two as we wind the conversation down. I understand that your first paycheck was 100 rand.
I don't know where you heard that, but that's true. Yeah?
I mean, that's the world has changed so much. It's quite remarkable that you've gone from 100 rand to whatever it is that you earn now, but it's going to be multiples of that.
That was in 73. Mm. That's what Article Clocks earned. And I remember it was a gross of 100 rand and 10 rand PAYE.
Yeah, wow.
So netted out 90. But then probably 6 years later, I was up to 950 rand and I qualified and I got a 50 rand increase. I went to 1,000 rand as a chartered accountant.
That must have been quite something.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
As you reflect back on those days, what are you hoping sticks from that period to now? Because the world is changing rapidly. We've got all this technological innovation that's happening, and it's remarkable and it's exciting, but there's also a potential loss. The baby being thrown out with the bathwater. Mm. What are you most hoping that that a young CEO who is listening, or a young future CEO that is listening, doesn't throw out as they are tempted into these new environments and new technologies?
You know, Gareth, I think, accounting should be, and reporting of financials and all that should be so simple. It should just be based on honesty and integrity.
Mm.
And if you stick to that principle right through your life, then I think you'll be a good accountant.
Okay, honesty and integrity.
I think so.
Are you a reader?
I read a bit, yeah, a little bit.
What book has had the most impact on you?
I would say it's Legacy. I think it's Legacy by a guy, a New Zealander, who I think is 15 points on leadership, and he, a guy called Kerr, I think it was, and he wrote about the All Blacks and their culture, and really a humble culture that they've got, and they're such a great team, and basically, I think the whole book was about that you need to leave the jersey in a better space when you hand it on to somebody else than what you picked it up in. And I think in business as well, I think that you can learn from that you need to leave the company in a better space than when you started.
Mm. The process that I described earlier, and I like the fact that the title is Legacy, the process that I described to you earlier, which was this acceptance first, then there's credibility, and then you need to leave something better than you found it, including the individuals that you're interacting with.
That's right.
The word that, when I was first taught this process, the word that they used there was legacy. And so I think in using some of the words that we've used here, we've closed the loop on that. I think and certainly what I felt like has happened here in studio is that you are leaving us empowered. There is certainly going to be a legacy and echoing of your influence sharing with us in studio. May I ask you one more question before we part company? And it's a question we ask all executives, all entrepreneurs, everyone that walks through the door that we talk to. And we ask them quite simply, if you could go back in time and talk to the young future CEO, 20-year-old you, what is that one piece of advice that you would give yourself if you were able to do that?
I think, the path I've followed is the path of hard work. And I believe that that's the way you do succeed. You know, some people might be able to succeed not working too hard, but that's the road that I was on, and that's how it's got to me to where I am at the moment.
Greg, thank you so very much for joining us here in studio. You're the CEO of Bravo Group, the largest, in fact, manufacturer of furniture in the country.
That's right.
Yeah. You represent a number of large brands that are household names. You support them by delivering on their promise. And we are so very grateful that you've been able to help us as we have been able to talk to you about how to do that ourselves. The impression that you're leaving with me certainly is one of the fact, and I'm just echoing what you've said, which is integrity, 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 integrity. And so I hope that that's part of what the message is that our listeners have heard today. Thank you again for joining us in studio.
Gareth, thanks for having me.
All right, that's all we have time for this week. We'll see you same time, same place next week with another CEO, another entrepreneur. Remember to go to cliffcentral.com or futureceos.com to download the podcasts. And there are a number of different features. Ask an Expert, Power Woman, Meet the CEO, and a number of others. Enjoy those there. We'll see you same time, same place next week.
Future CEOs on cliffcentral.com. This is cliffcentral.com.